Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Andrew Midgley stands at the helm of Africa's premier music company, Gresham Music Group, as its managing director. His leadership and keen industry insight have been pivotal in catapulting the careers of award-winning local artists such as Rouge, Connell Cruz, Jimmy Nevis, and Jesse Clegg. Andrew's influence extends beyond the African continent. He is a significant force in the global music business, having made substantial contributions through his work with prominent organizations like CSAC, IFAR, SAMPRA, and RISA. His extensive experience and dedication continue to shape the future of the music industry, both locally and internationally. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Andrew Midgley.
Where in the world are you and how are you doing?
I am in my office in Johannesburg, in Woodmead at the studios, and I'm doing fantastic, thank you.
Okay, so your fascination or passion for music, whether as a child or teenager, when did that start and how did that journey progress to where your current role is of managing director at Gresham?
Well, I think I've always loved music. Music and sport have always been my two passions. And I really found my way into the world and the business of music when I was 15 years old. I started a DJ company with two of my mates, and we started playing parties. And we carved out this little niche where we would play all the school parties, all the high school parties, matric dances. And by the age of 17, I was starting to play in clubs. I was starting to get residencies in clubs. And I'd worked up a bit of a reputation for myself, and I was getting bookings. But at the same time, I had finished school and I studied radio broadcasting, where I majored in radio broadcasting and public relations. And I very quickly started to realize that I didn't enjoy being in the clubs. So I kind of set my targets in terms of getting into the business side of music. And I started as an intern at David Gresham Records 20 years ago. And worked. I'd finished my diploma at Boston Media House in radio broadcasting, and then got offered a job as a junior product manager at the label, which was a dream come true because I really loved what the company was doing at the time, and they were doing some incredible productions for bands like Prime Circle and Cutting Jade and Wunderboom, and it was a really exciting time to start off in the music business because it was also at the time where physical sales were really impressive. And then I built my way up. So I was a junior product manager, moved into marketing manager. And when I was 27, I got appointed as the chief operations officer of the company. So effectively kind of second in line to David Gresham. And last year, I got appointed as the managing director as David moved on to become the group chairman.
What does a product manager do in a record label?
So a product manager is essentially responsible for getting the product ready for market.
Yes.
So the first product that I got to manage was the Tony Rich Project. And we put the record out. You make sure that it's ready for production, and then obviously ready for the sales reps to take out. You know, back in the day, we were still selling the physical product, which was very exciting. And essentially, you're there for the whole process. Also, part of that process was becoming an A&R manager. So in the A&R process, I was signing artists, getting them ready for studio production, getting them time in the studio, making sure that we selected the right songs for them, getting them market ready, getting the production of their album artwork, photo shoots, getting the whole thing ready for production. And the first group that I ever signed was Khalil, who actually, I was quite lucky because my first product that I put out got two Sama nominations. We didn't win, but at least it was something. So yeah, I mean, that's essentially what a product manager does.
Okay, so A&R means artist and representation. Is that correct?
Artist and repertoire.
Oh, artist and repertoire. Okay, I've learned something new. I always thought it was artist and representation. Okay, interesting. You referenced in that discussion a moment ago that you said that you made sure that, or part of that role is making sure that they choose or have the correct songs. So does that mean they send a batch of songs that they've created to you as part of the label, and then you guys collaborate to see, okay, which would be the best to put out there as part of the body of work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you're signing an artist, I mean, really signing them off the back of what they've created or presented to you previously, then you've got to understand where they want to go in terms of the new product. And the best way to do that is we always work on a demo system where we will put them in studio, put any artist into studio and say, let's create, let's see what's in your head, let's see where you want to go. And then, you know, we all sit down together as the A&R team and say, okay, look, there's something really good here, or look, there's a couple songs that are good, but we still need potential singles. Then we start discussing with the artist. Either we create new songs with them, new demos with them, or we say, okay, look, let's look to collaborate from a songwriting point of view outside of our infrastructure or outside of the group or outside of the artist. And then we come back again and say, okay, look, we have 20 or 30 demos, and now we're going to cut the following five or the following 10 for the album or two because we need a single. And then, you know, it's always good to select from an abundance as opposed to selecting from a very narrow channel where, you know, it's very difficult to discern what's ready and what's not.
This is subjective, and I understand asking this question, and there's no science formula to it because obviously everyone be adapting that science formula to the process. But as a perceptive of yours, how do you feel a song can be or has the elements to be chosen to be released for a single compared to another song that will just be a song on the album?
I wish there was a straightforward answer to that because, you know, then I'd have 17 Ferraris parked outside. unfortunately, there is no formula. I mean, at the end of the day, we've got to say, like, is there market relevance? Like, are we making music that actually would potentially hit at radio or on streaming platforms? That's always the first port of call is, are we actually even in the right pond here? From there, I think we really look for exceptional performances from a vocal point of view or for instrumentation point of view. You know, a great melody is always very important and a great lyric structure. So if all of those things line up and we also have a committed artist that's prepared to take the music to the world, you know, there's often times where we will keep reiterating, you know, in the studio in terms of what needs to change until we get to a point where the product is ready for release. And then we put it out and we pray.
You've referenced this a couple of times, and I know you and I have discussed this sort of in person when we were at the Music X. Putting it to you again, I love me a CD. I love the journey of the choice, the unpacking, the receiving, the booklet. For me, it's an energy exchange to say thank you to the artists for all the hard work that they're doing, creating that piece of art as it is. As mentioned to you before, upsurges in overseas more than here, simply because there's not really access in South Africa, as we know. But 5.9 million sales in UK, the biggest since 1990 of vinyls. CDs are an upsurge again in the UK. There's a basket of products that they monitor for exchanges. And based on that, on the upsurge of CDs again, that product is back in their basket. A vinyl factory just reopened in Asia about 3-4 months ago that had been closed for 50 years. And the research is showing that it's the teenagers, the late teens, the early 20s that are diving into the physical world. Some of the reasons they say is because they're tired of just having everything on their phone or up in the air. They like the aesthetic of holding something. But as you already referenced, also we've also got these streaming platforms that people consume music on. What are your observations of the landscape at the moment?
Look, there's no question that from an artistic point of view, to have the tactile, touchy feeling of the product. I mean, I always my greatest album that I've ever bought was Smashing Pumpkins Melancholy. I think the booklet's like 50 pages long. If you're able to experience the music with the pictures, with the lyrics, with the, you know, it gives you an extra layer in terms of the artistry that I always appreciated. And I think in many ways, there are a lot of products that never actually impact in South Africa purely because we have a very limited physical market. I mean, there is no chain of stores. There's very small independent stores. I mean, to buy CDs there isn't even a CD manufacturing plant. I mean, there are independent places that make CDs. I mean, we haven't produced a physical product for 7 years, you know, and at the same time for us to actually manufacture vinyl and bring it into the country is very expensive. Yeah. And that's why you're seeing products like Dark Side of the Moon retailing for like R1,000. I mean, it's crazy to think that people are actually purchasing that at that price. I mean, considering that back when CDs were relevant, R150 for a CD was very expensive. So, yes, I mean, there's no doubt. I would love a universe or I mean, from a South African point of view, where you could have the option of picking up the vinyl or picking up the CD or listening to it on streaming platforms. I mean, you won't be able to listen to it in your car. You know, the cars don't have CD players anymore.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that the worlds can live together in nice harmony. I mean, I was at HMV in London at the beginning of the year, and I walked in and I felt like I'd gone into a time machine, because Pearl Jam's new album was blasting like at full volume.
Yes.
There was a full top 20 of CDs that were pressed. There was vinyl everywhere, and people were buying it in the bucket load. So
yes,
it's strange. You know, it depends where in the world you are. I mean, Japan has an incredibly strong physical market. The US, obviously, the UK, very passionate about it. France, but yeah, I'd be delighted if that could come back to South Africa. But yes. We just simply do not have the facilities to actually manufacture it.
When I budget for my CDs and I get them from Amazon UK generally, and for me, even when we still, for the overseas listeners and for South African listeners who do not know, where we had Musica and Look and Listen as sort of the franchises, I got a little bit frustrated because many of the artists, they released the deluxe edition, which normally had like anywhere from 2 to 10 extra songs and a couple of remixes and et cetera, et cetera. And I found that in South Africa, we always got the normal, in inverted commas, release with the 10 or 11 songs. We never got the deluxe ones. And I thought, if I'm going to be paying the money, I want to get the deluxe one. So I got into the habit from getting the CDs in any case from Amazon, UK or US back at that stage. Now, for a fan who sees an artist on the stage, buys maybe a CD every now and then, goes to a concert every now and then, who feels and sees and thinks the industry so glamorous and is easy, can you give us the steps it takes pre to an album launch? What are the steps to get there before an artist releases a music, a single, or an album to the world?
Look, I think, first of all, you need a degree of talent. I mean, that kind of goes without saying.
Yeah.
I think you need to be able to recognize what exactly it is. You know, I think a lot of the time, great singers want to be great songwriters, or great songwriters want to be great singers. But, you know, to be all of that and to also be a great performer, dancer, you know, showman, you know, I think the sooner you can come to the realization that you are one or the other, or you are really all three, I think that's the most important kind of self-realization in terms of, well, I'm a very good songwriter, but I'm an average singer, or I'm a terrible dancer, a terrible performer. I'm going to be a singer, or I'm going to be a songwriter. Or if you are one of the blessed ones that can actually do all of it, then go for it. Then it comes down to great songs. You know, the thing is that I think a lot of the time people are so worried about the end product that they forget about the importance of just writing the great songs. You know, like, I get incredibly frustrated by artists that will bring in these amazing productions, but the songs are not quite average. You know, it's almost like you've skipped the whole step. Start with the songs, demo them acoustically. You know, I've always found that wherever I've gone to see shows anywhere in the world, if I see an artist that performs a song, you know, very acoustic, stripped back, of a big production, and it still hits me the same way the full production does, it's a great song. And you can build the production after that. Get those demos done, get those acoustic versions done, and then choose the producer you want. The mixing, the mixing and the mastering is very important, but it is, again, end of the line stuff. You know, so great song, right producer, and then kind of finish it off with the right studio in terms of mixing and mastering. And then I'd say once you've got all of that ready, test it out in a live environment, test it out beyond your friends and family.
Yes.
Because friends and family often are not going to tell you the truth.
Yes.
And then, you know, make a decision. Is this the best presentation or representation of yourself right now to put out into the world? And then put it out and you know, the world will decide its success. I mean, I don't really think that there's any such thing as kind of bad music or bad art or anything. At the end of the day, it's what it is you've produced. So really, I would try and follow those steps before I put anything out.
Obviously, each label is different, but from your team's perspective, are you guys involved when artists perform live and go on tour, or is that something separate outside of the label's interaction with them, or is it, do they overlap? How does it work?
Look, you do get some labels that are involved in the full 360 operations of the artist. So our company doesn't do that.
Okay.
You know, we like to specialize in the recording and in the administration, marketing, publishing, etc. But always what we try and do is, and, you know, it's very difficult for an artist to go on tour without a product. So yes, we focus on the product. We make sure that, you know, there's a reason for that artist to go on tour. And obviously, we will always aim for radio and really good placement on Spotify and Apple Music and create relevance that puts them on tour. And then, you know, a lot of the time that will kind of get handed over to an agent or to a booking company or a touring company. But certainly, I mean, because we are so closely linked to the network and to the industry, a lot of the time we'll call on favors from promoters and bookers and say, look, we know you've got an artist coming into the market. It would be great if you put Mr. X on to open. So we do assist, but it's not our focus.
Okay, so this is a controversial discussion because there's a lot of discussion around, you know, artists and the amount they get from streaming. And it's not really controversial, but I think there's a misinformation. So to give you an example, I was having a chat with 7-8 people who do my spinning class at the gym a couple of weeks ago. And I said to them, if an artist has had 100 million streams, how much money do you think they got? And all of them said 50 million. So I started laughing. I said, well, actually, no, it's only like 1,000. And they were all shocked and horrified to hear and understand that. So there's a lot of perception from sort of fans who maybe not as passionate, like sort of like music in the peripheral or go to a concert every now and then or have maybe one or two favorite artists, thinking that the artists with these streams are smashing it and coining it. And that's not really the case. Do you feel there needs to be more education around it for the buying public to understand what's going on? Or it will balance out as we move forward.
Look, I think it's also what the end user, you know, the customer, the person that signs up to Spotify and Apple Music, is prepared to pay for those services. So I don't know how it would normalize. I mean, if you think about it, and I mean, this is in the public domain. This is no secret. The record labels will receive 70% of that.
Okay.
So if you're paying 100 Rand for your Spotify subscription, there's 70 Rand immediately going to the music industry. You know, then it depends. You know, if you're talking about 100 million streams when there are a trillion streams in a month on the service, your market share keeps getting diluted by everyone else's streams. I mean, if you think about Spotify, they've now introduced this. If you're not getting 1,000 streams a month, you don't get paid. So I think that is a way of kind of making sure that the more successful artists get a bigger percentage of that market share, which I think is at least something. But I think at the end of the day, because there's music is so easy to make these days, and I mean, contrary to what Daniel X said, it does cost money to make music. Trust me, I know. Our studios do cost money, and it is very expensive. You know, Daniel X made a statement saying that it's quite cheap to make music, or it's free. Or he made some like really interesting comment, and it didn't go down so well. it does cost money. So yeah, I mean, I can't imagine that the public would all of a sudden say we're prepared to pay 300 Rand for music because it will pay artists more. I don't think that's going to happen. And also, I'd be very surprised if Spotify could actually give away more than 70% and still keep their business, you know, profitable. The people that are often at the lowest end of the value chain that I definitely think needs a correction is the composers, Because if people only talk about the artist payments, there's also the composers.
Yes.
And a lot of composers are not the artist. And the composer's share that they're getting from streaming services is a fraction of what the artists are getting. You know, so there needs to be some sort of – something's got to happen because there would be no recordings if there were no compositions, right?
Exactly. It's an interesting discussion and conversation. I love having this conversation. So now I know this is, again, subjective to you based on your experience and perceptions. What is it about an artist that you think, ah, I want to work with that person? What is it? Is it a gut feeling, combination of talent, combination of energy? For you, what are the – different pieces of the puzzle that create the picture?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a great question because I've signed so many different kinds of artists for different reasons. You know, there isn't a mold that fits it. I mean, if I think about when I signed Jesse Clegg, you know, he came to us with effectively well-produced demos that actually became the album. You know, I actually had to fight internally to say, listen, put it out as is. We don't have to redo anything on this album. Just put it out and it'll work. And I got lucky that the songs and the production was really good and it worked well. You know. And then we've also spent a lot of money producing records overseas that were complete flops. But when it comes to me, I mean, I think the first thing is you've got to be able to connect with the artist just kind of on a personal level and say, like, first, is this someone I want to work with? You know, like all the talent in the world, if we can't just have good communication and have a common cause, which is we want to make great music and we want to be absolutely, you know, the biggest artist in the world, you know, it always starts with that conversation. And a lot of the time what will happen with artists is they will tell you whatever you want to hear to get the contract signed.
Yes.
And then when they get into the studio, then it's like, no, hang on. Actually, that's not what we do. We do something completely different. Right. And immediately, you know, it falls flat. So, yeah, look, it's – but in terms of what do I look, what is the absolute X factor for me, it's something unusual. It's different. You know, it's got to be able to make people feel something, you know, like as opposed to kind of just very generic stuff. Like I always try and find something and really – either cuts deep into from a message point of view or a lyric point of view, melody point of view. You know, if you get out there and you're able to pull that off on a stage and make me feel that way, you know, and then I'm able to go and listen to the record by myself and I still feel that way, you know, then I think that's a starting point in terms of if you're making me feel this, hopefully you can make many millions of people feel this.
Yeah. Okay, so you reference when that flops, like, and there's expensive investment. So when a flop happens and it's, you don't know why, obviously there's no reason why, because it was brilliant. Everyone loved it. We had good reviews. How does yourself, the label, how do you guys pick yourself up and keep going? Because obviously it will happen periodically or however and often. What are the things that you say to yourself and the team and the artists say, okay, it's this, let's just move on for it. What are those elements?
Yeah, look, I think it really depends on whether you know they've got more gas in the tank. In such a small market like South Africa, I think we're the 25th biggest market in the world. I mean, we're a really small market, you know, and for a lot of South African artists, it's very difficult to create a sustainable career, you know, long-term, you know, where you're actually able to pay yourself a monthly salary. A lot of people still have to work second jobs, you know, do all sorts of other things outside of being a musician. And unfortunately, I've seen it so often that if the first album or the second album doesn't absolutely smash it, a lot of these artists just quit. You know, they just can't sustain it. They can't stomach the failure. You know, from a company point of view, from an investment point of view, it's like, look, it costs us a lot of money to put a record out. It costs us almost twice as much money to promote the record. And then we go, well, you know, if an artist is truly like behind it and says, look, I've got something, and they we put them back in studio and they produce up some new demos and they're like, wow, you know, yes, we can have another go at it, then we do. So it really comes down to a couple of factors, but like the will and the desire of the artist is very important, especially when it comes to failure. I mean, if we look at it, we put out Nickelback. Their first two albums from a commercial point of view were not successful. You know, but their parent label, being Roadrunner Records, believed in them, and album three delivered. I mean, there's some albums, some artists that album 4 or 5 deliver. You know, whether they stick around on one label to get to that point is very unlikely. But I suppose, again, it's the will and the desire of the artist to be successful and say, listen, we are artists and I don't actually care if it's successful on this label or on that label. I'm going to keep doing it because you can't take my artistry away.
What are you excited about in the industry as a whole that you feel it's the same thing? Music will always be there. It comes and flows in different physical, digital. But are there any elements that you feel excited about over the next while that will reignite passion or reignite certain things in the industry that you think maybe have been lost for a period of time?
Well, absolutely. I still think we're coming into the golden age of the music industry from a business point of view. And that's purely because we're at the convergence of technology and data. So let me unpack that a bit for the audience, because for the longest time, music has been used, but it hasn't been paid for. Or it has been paid for, but it hasn't been attributed to the people that it should be getting.
Yes.
That revenue. So, for example, when it comes to radio stations, you know, the fact that we're able to now fully track what they're playing, you know, through services like Radio Monitor or AF Stereo or Nielsen. So you're actually able to see, okay, the value of my song is this. The fact that we're able to track that data all over the world now. I mean, if you think about Africa, for example, when the industry puts out these industry reports and they say, you know, music revenues are up 20% in Africa, what they don't tell you is that most of that is from South Africa. What about the rest of Africa? And I think where we're going to get to is we're going to be able to start monitoring, tracking, getting out there and making sure that our rights are remunerated in the proper way. Because, you know, it's one thing to say, okay, well, if they don't declare to us what it is that they play, we're gonna hit them with a copyright infringement.
Yeah.
And the thing is, okay, well, prove it. We have the proof now.
Okay.
You know, so it's a matter of enforcement. And I think that's very exciting because, you know, companies are able to get out there managing huge amounts of data and making sure that, okay, yes, we can track it, we can attribute it to the right people, and we can do the licensing properly. People always think that music pirates are those that make USB sticks and burn CDs. That's not the case. There are major corporations around the world that are using music that are not paying artists.
Okay.
And I think that once we're able to call them out and once we're able to get them licensed, again, the royalty revenue pool for the whole industry will continue to grow. And of course, that's to the benefit of the artists and the record labels and the publishers.
I like that. That sounds exciting and interesting. So, Andrew, I know if I had to ask you this question in 10 minutes, 10 years, 5 hours, I know your answer will be different every time because there are millions of them. I'm not saying favorite. I'm saying top of mind. So if you had to push play to 5 songs by artists once you finish this conversation, or you just had to choose 5 artists to play if you can't think of specific songs, which would those 5 artists be and or songs if you can mention them?
Oh, great question. Yeah. You know, I love making my own playlists all the time. Now that I don't make compilation CDs anymore, like that was quite I used to love that. I think it would depend on the mood, but if I were to start a party, I would probably go with something from the Ramones, something from Green Day, The Killers, Bruno Mars, and Timo Maas.
Okay.
The German DJ.
Okay, yes. Now, I know if I had to ask you this question again, literally now, you had to have another 5. That's why I love this game. So, Andrew, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message, what would you like to say to the audience?
I'd just like to say thank you very much for listening to music. Thank you for contributing to the industry that has given me and a lot of my friends and colleagues a career. And we look forward to what I think is, and I've alluded to it, the golden age of music. And I'm really looking forward to hearing new music. That's a beautiful thing about the industry is there's always something new. There's always someone doing something innovative and different. Technologies here. There are different tools at our disposal. And I'm really excited about the next 10 years of the music industry.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook @CelebSavant. That's CelebSavant.